Without a medical license would go, again, to the actual abilities and credentials that we don't know, that she didn't hash out with him. And two, the unlawful force or violence. While unlawful force is correct here, and consent would go to whether the touching was unlawful, that's an accurate statement as well. But it's just what came underneath it, merely agreeing to her summation and her conclusion, especially since we're talking about an individual and the appellant who's not trained in the law and would not know the distinctions between fraud and the inducement and fraud and the factum to the extent that we're bringing them out here. That's what makes this a problem. Otherwise, it's an accurate statement.
And what is it in Othier that is left open to be resolved that isn't resolved by this particular paragraph?
It is the notion of abilities versus credentials. Because if you, without...
So in your view, she, the military judge, had to ask him, and you also lack the ability to this, as well as lacking the medical license?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Othier expressly requires that in a situation where we're talking about medical capabilities, as opposed to, as noted earlier, something like SEAL training.
Othier does not talk explicitly about medical capabilities. I mean, it was designed for and written because of a SEAL case, but applying those principles, the credentials and actual abilities, it doesn't leave any way that you couldn't consider all of that, that you could not consider actual abilities.
But how does that particular point leave us with a substantial basis in law or fact to doubt that this guilty plea was provident on the facts of this particular case? I mean, he's admitted that his actual abilities were inferior to a legitimate gynecologist, that he doesn't have qualifications and that the exams were pretend. What more do we need?
We need it for the judge to get from him that a combination of actual abilities and credentials are what's the essence of an exam. Additionally, the judge needed to stop steering the discussion all the time to why they consented. She needed to look at what they consented to and how that was inferior to what they were expecting, not why they consented.
And why would it be that a military judge, in listening to this providency inquiry, would not proceed on the basis that something like a gynecological exam is not within the normal capability of an individual, and so that the question of ability would be subsumed in the question of license here?
That's a difficult question, but it would point out that you could just as easily say that drown-proofing training is outside of the capabilities of an ordinary individual. It's a very slippery slope. It's hard to draw the line.
Well, one's a learned profession and one isn't. One requires a license and one doesn't. I'm not aware of any drown-proofing license. Are you?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. I yield to the Chief Judge.
I don't have a further question. Thank you.
You said early on consent's not an element of the offense.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right.
That's correct.
Well, if it's not, why do we care whether or not the victim consents? I mean, isn't consent then just a matter of mitigation in sentencing? Doesn't that just go to the sentence? She consented in a fashion. You're trying to say she consented to something. First of all, what did she consent to?
As far as what did the victims in this case...
Yeah, what did they consent? You know, remember, you had one who was a little girl who'd never had a gynecological exam before.
Yes, Your Honor. And that one, and this is something that they did not explore in here, you get to, well, can the mother consent for her?
Because well, let's leave that aside.
Yes.
What did these women consent to?
As far as we can tell from the record, they consented to an exam from someone who purported to be a gynecology student, because that's what he told them. He said, hey, I'm a at least as far as what's in the Providence Inquiry, he said, hey, I'm a gynecology student, and I'd like to give you an exam.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, he was not a gynecology student.
No, Your Honor.
Okay. And was not trained to give the exams.
No, he was not trained.
And did not administer a proper exam.
As far as we can tell, no.
Well, I think that's in the Providence Inquiry, isn't it?
With the pretense aspect, or the legitimacy?
No, the fact that, mechanically speaking, he was not qualified and did not administer a proper exam. And then the Providence Inquiry.
To some extent, but the Providence Inquiry was so all over the place that it's very difficult to put it within the principles of fraud in the inducement, fraud in the factum, and Uthier.
Well, let's get to the second part of Judge Steuben's question. Where in the record does it address the question of whether the exam was or was not proper?
Proper in what sense, Your Honor?
Well, that was Judge Steuben. He asked a two-part question. Whether the individual was qualified to give an exam, and whether the individual admitted that the exam was not properly given. The second part may have some bearing on the question of the providency of the plea. So did the individual admit in the providency inquiry, or on the contrary, did he deny anything regarding the conduct of the examination?
May I address that on rebuttal?
That would be fine, thank you.
Counsel, we've talked about the fact that consent is not an element here, but is consent a defense? In Othier, I mean, that was why they found that it was not provident, because, in fact, defense was a consent, and the military judge did not discuss that during the providency inquiry. Where does consent even enter into this case? I haven't determined that yet from your argument.
Uthier leaves it up to the trier of fact, the military judge in a guilty plea, or the finder, if it were litigated, to determine if consent is material. And in this case, that never happened. It seems like she assumed that consent was material.
Well, to what purpose? I mean, is it material because it's a defense? If it's not a defense, who cares about consent? It's not an element, we know that.
Yes, it would be a defense then.
So in Othier, That's what they found, that it was a defense. And there they found that the plea was not provident because the military judge did not discuss that. But in this case, the military judge did discuss that. Isn't that correct?
Well, I would disagree slightly with Uthier. In Uthier, they sent it back, or this court sent it back to the military judge to determine whether or not consent was...
He said, we cannot uphold a conviction for the lesser included offense of assault consummated by a battery because the issue of consent as a defense was not addressed during the plea inquiry. That's just at the end of the... Judge Cox's decision. So it seems to me that there they broke the plea because they didn't discuss consent as a defense. In this case, they did discuss consent. And so I'm trying to figure out where that case gives you any support.
They did discuss consent, but we submit that she did not, the military judge did not address the correct principles when she discussed consent, specifically what fraud in the factum was, what fraud in the inducement was, and how they applied to this case.
And I guess my question is, do they apply to this case? Because since this was a, since Othier appears to have been decided on an improper providency inquiry, isn't a lot of the rest of that discussion just dicta?
Dicta, but also guidance for how this, how Othier was to be carried out. And we have no idea, because there was no follow-up to Othier, how Othier was to be handled when it got down back to the trial level, what factors the judge was to consider. And so here, what we have is a similar, probably the closest case to Othier itself that we've had since then. So it would only make sense to look to those principles as persuasive authority.
Thank you.
Your time is just about up, so unless you have something real short, you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal to address anything further and sum up.
Yes, I will do that, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Captain Jamie Mendelson, and together with Colonel Gerald Bruce, the government in this case. Appellant's pleas of guilty to assault consummated by a battery were provident. He did not have legal consent of his victims to perform a phony gynecological exam, and the military judge did not abuse her discretion in accepting his pleas of guilty. In this case, the appellant engaged in a pattern of deception where he met women on the internet and convinced each woman that he met that he was in training to become a gynecologist and that he had the training and qualifications to perform a legitimate gynecological exam. He then performed phony gynecological exams on 7 different women, each time inserting a speculum, taking swabs, drawing blood, doing the actions that mimicked an actual exam. All of his victims were convinced that he, in fact, had the qualifications and training to perform a legitimate medical procedure. As a result of his misconduct, appellant was charged with indecent assault, and at trial he pled guilty to the lesser-included offense of assault consummated by a battery, and then the government went on to prove the greater offense of indecent assault. During the providence inquiry, the military judge explained the elements of assault consummated by a battery and also explained to appellant that for an act to constitute a battery, the act must be without the lawful consent of the victim. The military judge also provided the general definitions of the concepts of fraud in the inducement and fraud in the factum, explaining to appellant that fraud in the factum is a misrepresentation as to the nature of the acts performed, and if consent is obtained through fraud in the factum, it is not valid consent. During the providence inquiry, the military judge elicited a sufficient factual basis to determine...
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Leaving aside the child for a moment, what did these women get? What did they receive from the appellant? What did the appellant do to them?
Well, they certainly did not receive a medical procedure. And what the government ended up proving is that...
Well, they did not receive a procedure performed by a credentialed medical professional. What did they get?
Well,
mechanically speaking...
Mechanically speaking, they... What they got was not a medical procedure. He mimicked the actions of a gynecological exam by inserting speculum and taking swabs, but the nature of the act, when you're talking about a medical procedure like a gynecological exam, is not just the mechanical acts. It's for a medical diagnostic purpose.
After the exams, again, leaving the child aside, did any of these women think they had not received a medical exam? What did they think they had received post-exam, post-incident?
Each of the women, because they later testified on findings for the government's case for the greater offense, each of the women testified that at least the initial exam they believed was medical in nature, and they truly believed that they were receiving a medical procedure. One of the victims believed...
Including the one that took place in the U-Haul. Never mind that. That's an aside. Go ahead.
Well, the victim where the exams took place in the U-Haul, she did indicate that on the second exam there may have been more of a sexual nature to it, but certainly the first exam she thought was completely medical in nature.
Mm-hmm. And how many of these women eventually engaged in consensual intercourse with the appellant?
Not all of them, but the majority of them. Appellant did not have a sexual relationship with the victim, Leanne Sackman, and the two minors. So four of the victims at one time or another were in a sexual relationship with the appellant. However, it was clear from their testimony that the context of these phony exams was purely in a medical context, regardless of the fact that they may have also had a sexual relationship with the appellant.
Did the relationship start before or after the exams in question?
Most of the victims who testified that they had a sexual relationship with the appellant testified that their sexual relationship existed both before and after
the four
exams.
The four said that, or how many of the four?
Actually, I believe all four said that they had a sexual relationship with him both before and after the exam.
And might that have put them on notice that he was not a real doctor?
I mean, doctors have personal lives too. So, I mean, the fact that they were in an intimate relationship with this appellant, that doesn't necessarily put them on notice of any kind.
Was that explored during the care inquiry?
The sexual relationships were not explored during the care inquiry. The reason being that he was pleading to assault consummated by battery. The defense theory at trial was that this was he was impersonating a doctor for his own self-esteem purposes. He wasn't doing this for a sexual purpose. That was the defense theory, which ultimately failed at trial. But the Providence inquiry focused on it was solely for the lesser included offense of assault consummated by a battery. So the sexual context didn't surface during the care inquiry.
When and where is that information contained? Where is that information contained about the sexual relationships that you're talking about now?
During the government's case in chief, when the government went on to prove the greater offense of indecent assault for each one of these seven specifications, and the seven victims testified, four of them testified about having a sexual relationship with the appellant.
Counsel, as I understand the defense use of Othier, and by all means the defense amplify or revise if I've misstated, it's that there's a need to explore both credentials and abilities in the Providence inquiry, and that a person who, if their credential was somehow deficient as a doctor, who nonetheless, through self-study, developed the ability and in fact performed a medical examination, that would, under Othier, not constitute an offense or at least leave something to be decided by a fact finder. So the question that I have here is with respect to the question of ability as opposed to credential, where does the providency inquiry resolve that? And if it doesn't, how would you distinguish Uthia from this case? That is, how do we know from the providency inquiry that this is an individual who lacked the ability to conduct the medical exam and that did not, in fact, conduct the medical exam?
Yes, Your Honor. For each specification during the providence inquiry, appellant stated that he told his victims that he was qualified to perform the exams when, in fact, he had no qualifications. He stated that he had no training. He stated that he had no medical license. And the where Uthier is distinguished on this point, Your Honor, is that in Uthier, with the nature of the act that was at issue there, a drown-proofing exercise, that act is not necessarily of a nature where a certain qualification or credential would be essential to being able to actually perform the act that the person consented to. In Uthier, there was some evidence that indicated...
Really? You think that if a military commander ordered his NCOs to conduct ground-proofing exercises and didn't provide any of them with their requisite training, and as a result, a recruit died, there wouldn't lie a good dereliction of duty charge there?
Well, Your Honor, that would be a different case than Uthier, because in Uthier there was evidence to indicate that although that appellant was not, in fact, a Navy SEAL, he did have extensive training and had qualifications to perform a drown-proofing exercise, to instruct such an exercise and ensure that cadet's safety.
So here, is it the admission to a lack of any training that is the critical distinction from Uthier in terms of, in the government's view, saving the providency inquiry in this case?
Your Honor, yes, that is a critical distinction, as well as the fact that the nature of the act that's at issue is very relevant and can change the landscape of the analysis. When you're talking about a gynecological exam and someone consenting to a gynecological exam, it's really twofold. It's consent to a legitimate medical diagnostic procedure, as well as consenting to having that procedure done by a medical provider who has the requisite training and qualifications. And this is analogous to this court's holding in Booker, which was a rape case, but the issue there was the victim consented to sexual intercourse, but she did so only upon the belief that the appellant in that case was actually her boyfriend. And the Booker court held that when it comes to the act of sexual intercourse, the factum, or the nature of the act, involves both knowing that what you're consenting to is in fact sexual intercourse, as well as at least knowing the identity or some identity of who your partner is. When you're talking about a gynecological exam, it's not necessarily the true identity that's critical. Rather, it's the qualifications and the training and the ability of the person who performs the exam. Because the nature of it...
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but isn't it also have something to do with what is actually being done? I mean, the fact that he's using speculars and swabs, I mean, is he doing anything with the swabs? Is he sending the samples anywhere? Was anything asked about that at the Providence Inquiry? I mean, didn't he just pretend to go through the motions and nothing else?
Certainly. And that's what he did, is he mimicked an exam. But an airman from a motor pool who inserts a speculum into a woman, that doesn't make it a gynecological exam.
And in Uthier, didn't the person actually receive training? I mean, didn't the appellant actually give his victim some training?
That's what the facts in Uthier indicated, Your Honor.
Isn't that a critical distinction?
That is a critical distinction, absolutely, which all ties into the traditional distinctions between fraud and the inducement and fraud and the factum. And in this case, it's fraud and the factum, because what the victims consented to is not what in fact happened. They consented to a medical procedure to be performed by someone who had the qualifications to do it, when in fact what they got was something other than a medical procedure. It may have mimicked the actions of the medical procedure, but it certainly was not a medical procedure, and it was performed by an airman who worked in the motor pool who had no medical training, qualifications, or license. If there are no further questions, I will conclude.
Please do so.
In this case, the military judge elicited a sufficient factual basis to determine that the fraudulently obtained consent was not a valid defense in appellant's case. Appellant's misrepresentations about his training and qualifications amounted to fraud in the factum. He did not perform a legitimate medical procedure as his victims believed that they were consenting to. His misrepresentations were material and essential to obtaining his victim's consent, as he stated in his Providence inquiry. Thus, his guilty pleas were provident, and this court should affirm. Thank you.
Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor had asked if there was any evidence that he had admitted that the exams were not proper exams. And looking back at the record, it's really unclear. What you don't have is you don't have him discussing what a real gynecologist would bring to the fight, if you will. How care from a real gynecologist outside of having a medical license would be any different than what he would have provided.
What was done with the swabs and the blood samples?
The record does not indicate what happened there. Now, if he would have talked about, well, a real gynecologist could look in those areas and determine this or that was wrong, but I couldn't do that, then that would get us to where we needed to be. But the judge did not go down that path.
Well, the government focused particularly on the question of training. And once the individual admits that he has no training in a scientific discipline, why isn't that sufficient for a providency inquiry under the facts of this case? That is, there's once the individual says not only do they lack a license, but they lack the training, why isn't that sufficient?
In this case, Your Honor, it's because of the way that it came up. It came up not out of appellant's mouth. Appellant had volunteered that he had lied. He didn't volunteer anything about training. That came out of the judge on the third victim. And the judge threw it out there almost accidentally, as if it were synonymous with not having credentials, not having training, rather than treating it as if it's something with a pretty significant legal difference here. So in that case, it would seem like an almost accidental finding of providency.
That's a new theory that we'll have here, the accidental finding of providency.
Your Honor, yes. With how the judge was very inexact with the terminology, with bringing some concepts in with some of the alleged victims and other concepts in with the other alleged victims, it's very difficult to say that the accused knowingly admitted here to what he needed to admit to.
We get to look at the entire providency inquiry, right?
Yes, Your Honor, this court does. Also, along the same lines, he did talk about not legitimate, but it's not clear if that's not legitimate because he had no medical license or if it's not legitimate because he couldn't diagnose a condition that he would have to diagnose as a gynecologist. And then at the end, when pretend comes up, prompted by the way the specifications were phrased, pretend always comes up in conjunction with authorized. So the question is it pretend because he was not authorized, or is it pretend because he was just fooling around down there and not really doing a proper exam? None of that was resolved.
Can't it be both? Can it both be pretend because he's not authorized, or pretend because he's not actually doing an exam?
It could be, but from the way it came out on the record of trial, Your Honor, we don't know. It leaves too much of an ambiguity. So we ask that this court set aside the pleas to the lesser included offenses, and then in turn set aside the convictions to indecent assault. Because in those cases, these principles of consent and fraud in the factum and fraud in the inducement would apply. Now, we know the military judges are presumed to have applied the law correctly, but if there's ever a case where you're going to say that something would overcome the presumption, it's a case where the military judge didn't have those concepts down for the lesser included offense. So on those grounds, we ask that the convictions be set aside.
Thank you, counsel.
And in closing, make no mistake about it, this case does involve some bizarre behavior, but when the stakes are as high as they were here, a dishonorable discharge and 7 years confinement, we owe it to our airmen to apply the law properly. So that's why these should be set aside. If there are no further questions, then I conclude.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your argument. The court will stand in recess until 10 minutes before 10 o'clock.
Our second case this morning is United States against Erickson. Is counsel for the defense ready to proceed?
Chief Judge Efron. Honorable judges, may it please the court. I am Captain Griffin Dunham, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Kelly Erickson. The issue before the court is whether trial counsel's improper argument during sentencing materially prejudiced the substantial right of Sergeant Erickson. You'll see from the record that right out of the gate, trial counsel wanted the case to be about a motion during the sentencing argument. In fact, his goal was to incite the passion of the military judge.
Is that the law of the case? Are we bound by the CCA determination that the argument was plain error?
No, Your Honor.
It is not the law of the case.
No, Your Honor. However, the facts do indicate that not only was there error, but that was plain and obvious, as the Court of Appeals at the Air Force level did indicate. Based on the facts of the case, the number of specifications, the incestuous nature of the offenses, the family relationships that were involved, the trial counsel wanted the judge to go back and deliberate upon the sentence with this emotion on the forefront of his mind. It wasn't to calmly deliberate about the objective facts, and he did so by first referencing Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and Adolf Hitler.
Can I ask you a couple questions about that? I mean, keeping in mind that this focus that you have on those particular individuals shows up in the first part of the argument only and is one of three bases that he has for the sentence that he asked for, he's really comparing evil that can be seen against evil that can be seen and is obvious and contrasting it with evil that's insidious and can't be guarded against, isn't he?
Yes, Your Honor.
And isn't that a fair characterization for a father that is systematically raping children under the ages of 10?
No,
that,
Your Honor.
It's not fair to say that it's evil that isn't obvious?
Your Honor, it is a fair argument for the trial counsel to say that it is evil. But as soon as trial counsel involved Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and Adolf Hitler, and actually stated that those individuals have an advantage over appellant because they were open and notorious about their evil, then it becomes error.
He's not saying that, is he? He's saying that the public has an advantage in dealing with evil if it's overt rather than covert. He's not saying that bin Laden and Hitler had an advantage.
Morally speaking, Your Honor, It's the appellant's position that when saying that they have an advantage, it's such that the evil is diminished or mitigated because of how notoriously those individuals represent themselves. So indeed, yes, the public is more aware, but also the gravity of the crimes has to be mitigated by virtue of the fact that there cannot be the extent of damage done because of how openly they commit their atrocities. And, Your Honor, if I may continue with your question, the references to Osama bin Laden and Adolf Hitler and Saddam Hussein, obviously any military judge can look at Sergeant Erickson sitting at the defense table and realize that that's not who he's dealing with. But by then including the quip that is in trial counsel's argument that the greatest trick the devil ever performed was convincing the world that he didn't exist, that's when the trial counsel actually focused the argument on religion / spirituality.
Okay, what evidence is there in the record that this military judge had any sort of religious tendencies or religious fervor or was going to be influenced by religious references at all?
There is no indication, Your Honor.
Okay, and how is this reference to the devil basically tricking people as to whether he exists at all? Let's instead insert Dorian Gray, who on the surface looks lovely and fine, but has a painting up in the attic that reflects his true self. I mean, what if he'd said that instead of the devil? Would your argument still be the same?
Yes, Your Honor. In this case, although we don't know if the military judge had any spiritual tendencies or religious preferences, we don't want to turn this into a religion-type argument, only to the extent that we say that there is a commonly recognized, not necessarily inner spirituality in everybody, but at least inner morality that recognizes that there is good, there is evil, if you want to label as that, and there is this inherent opposition that sometimes manifests itself as the devil in people who have a religious tendency.
How do you deal with the presumption that judges are supposed to know the law, presumed to know the law?
Yeah, please repeat the question.
How do you deal with the presumption that judges are presumed to know the law? And presumably a judge would know that he's not supposed to sentence defendants based on what they think about Adolf Hitler.
Yes, Your Honor. When, obviously, judges are presumed to know the law, however, one, judges are humans. The natural and the inherent fallibility within everybody suggests that even they can be sometimes affected, influenced by an overly emotional appeal that is based upon inflammatory passions that trial counsel injects at the level that he did during the argument. If we look at Fletcher, it better answers the question what I've just articulated by looking at the severity of the misconduct and also the curative measures as well as the weight of the evidence.
How do you deal with Beraz-Martinez, where this court, in a divided court, decided that it was not plain error to refer to someone as almost a traitor and discuss treason? If that's not plain error, why is this plain error?
Your Honor, because as soon as the trial counsel generates this level of, I don't want to keep calling it spirituality, but whenever they appeal to someone's emotions on a religious type level, then it takes it out of the realm of being able to.
So your focus is religion here and not Adolf Hitler or Osama bin Laden, et cetera?
Correct, Your Honor.
So it's the statement about comparing him to the devil and not the statement that we granted on, which is a reference about Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, and Osama bin Laden?
It's taken together, Your Honor. As soon as the trial counsel mentions Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, and Osama bin Laden, that sets the baseline. And then it enhances the damage that was done as soon as trial counsel says that those three have an advantage over what appellant did, because the appellant is actually a demon.
They're not saying that they don't misrepresent what he says. He doesn't say that they have an advantage over appellant because he's a demon. They said that it's easy. It's society has an advantage in dealing with evil that is open and notorious than with evil such as the one that he characterizes appellant committing here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so let's just be clear about precisely what trial counsel said.
Yeah.
Do you argue that a life sentence is out of bounds for the offenses that the accused was found guilty of here?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for what reason?
For one, there was mitigation evidence that was offered at trial, and it actually came out in the appellate exhibits, as well as the fact that appellant pled guilty. Appellant turned himself in these atrocities that he did commit, and then was trying to take that first step towards rehabilitation. And
doesn't this all sound inappropriateness?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Doesn't this all sound inappropriateness? Sentence appropriateness, which isn't our function.
Correct, Your Honor, and that's what appellant's trying to avoid. We don't want to turn this into a sentence comparison case, but by looking at...
Well, appropriateness and comparison aren't exactly the same thing.
Yes, Your Honor.
We don't have appropriateness power.
Yes,
so,
Your Honor.
So why are you arguing that?
It's probably my fault, Judge Duke, asking an artful question. I think probably the question I wanted to ask you is, even assuming that any of us agreed with you that this was error and it was plain, how, given the overall offenses in this case and the overall sentencing evidence that was produced by trial counsel as well as defense counsel, as well as the statements given by the different victims during the case, can you say that these two references at the beginning of a closing argument on prejudice the accused?
Your Honor, when it comes to the aspect of the amount of space that it took up during the argument, although it was 22 pages long and there was a reference at the beginning, the themes that the trial counsel had throughout the entire argument all were intertwined with that initial paragraph, speaking about manipulation over 20 times during the argument. He talks about appellant being manipulative.
Isn't that fair argument in a case involving a father manipulating two children under the age of 10 in sexual relations over a period of years?
Your Honor, by itself, it is a fair argument. But since the trial counsel set the tone of the entire argument by the improper argument regarding the three individuals as well as the devil, that just goes to show that the weight of the argument was tailored towards the improprieties that were initially committed in the first paragraph, and then tying it up at the end by saying that society should not have to suffer one day, and ultimately that he was going to be going to hell.
Counsel, I'd like to turn back to the granted issue in this case. And if we proceed on the basis of whether there was plain error, then, and the government has conceded that there was error. So here, in terms of the sentence, my understanding is that the defense is not contending that the sentence was inappropriate as a matter of law. That is, that the individual could have been sentenced to life in prison. It's that the argument created prejudice in this case. So in what specific way did the error prejudice this specific sentence?
It affected it because it was much higher as a result of.
Much higher than what? What are we looking at here?
It is higher than what the judge would have otherwise have given. In the record, it's impossible for us to deduce what he would have judged if he didn't have to hear the improper argument of trial counsel. And that's why in the appellant's brief, we try to analogize the case to similar cases where there was much less confinement time offered. And looking at the Hicks case and the Hansen decision, the prejudice is revealed because somewhat similar facts have not resulted in the similar types of punishments that were handed down.
So your sentence comparison is solely for the issue of prejudice, not for the issue of showing that the sentence by itself was inappropriate?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And the further severity is shown, or at least the prejudicial effect is shown, and appellant does not try to minimize the seriousness of his conduct, but at the same time, the record, the testimony of Dr. Coleman does not indicate that there are necessarily going to be long-term effects affecting BE as well as AE, although her prognosis was poor. The current diagnosis could not support a finding that there was indeed going to be verifiable injury. Your Honor, I see that I have exceeded my time.
You'll have an opportunity to sum up and conclude on your rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. Judge Efron, honorable members of the court. Good morning. My name is Major Kimani Eason. I, along with Colonel Gerald Bruce, represent the United States in this proceeding. Trial counsel's passing references in the sentencing argument to Adolf Hitler, Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, and the devil did not materially prejudice the appellant's rights.
Does the government concede this is plain error?
No, Your Honor. The government does,
does not concede this is plain error.
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
In our brief, we mentioned that to the extent that counsel sought to unduly inflame the passions of the sentencing authority with his argument, that would be error. However, we do not believe that trial counsel sought to do that in his references to, or in, by mentioning, if you will, Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, and the others.
Where do you say that in your brief? Where do you say that, that you're not conceding that this is error?
Your Honor, if you look on page 3, in the law and analysis portion.
Mm-hmm. You're relying, you say, to the extent counsel sought to do that, so you're arguing that if he in fact sought to do that, it would be plain error, but we don't know what he did. So why is he bringing this stuff up?
I think he's just trying to put into context.
So the appropriate context for discussion of child sexual abuse is Adolf Hitler?
No, not at all, Your Honor. Not at all. However, simply because the trial counsel made references to a notorious figure, that doesn't amount to error. And I want to note for the court that this was a 20-plus page argument. The only time that Adolf Hitler or Osama bin Laden.
And we're just I was just focusing on the first issue, though, or first point of discussion, which is whether the government believes this was plain error or not. The first part's a plain error, not the prejudice part.
Right.
Judge Baker, may I turn back to the brief on
yeah,
that?
Sure.
As I look at page 3, there are two sentences. To the extent counsel sought to do that by making references in his argument to Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, and the devil, it was error. However, appellant has not demonstrated how this error materially prejudices substantial right, going to the latter part of the plain error test. So while the government has not conceded here that there was plain error, this appears to me to be an express concession that the first prong of the plain error test, that is, that there was error, is met. It says this error.
Your Honor, in the first sentence, I state it is improper for trial counsel to seek unduly to inflame the passions and prejudices of the sentencing authority. To the extent counsel sought to do that, i.e., inflame the passions and prejudices of the sentencing authority, that would be error. And assuming arguendo that that's what he sought to do, that's when I go into the next.
That's not what it says. It says, however, appellant has not demonstrated how this error materially prejudices substantial rights. And I may have missed something, but I didn't see anything in your brief that contested the first prong of the plain error test. Didn't see anything in here in which you said this was perfectly fine for the trial counsel to make these references to Saddam, Adolf Hitler, Osama bin Laden, and the devil. As I understood your argument, it's that this error did not meet the remainder of the plain error test.
I think it's, Your Honor, I think it's a misunderstanding of what I was trying to say.
Okay, well, show me in the brief where you say that this is a perfectly good argument for trial counsel to make.
I didn't say that that was a perfectly good argument to
make. That it's an acceptable argument for him to make. That it's not error for him to make this argument.
I didn't say that it was error or not error, but assuming that it was error, that the error did not materially prejudice the appellant's rights.
So is it fair to say that you don't concede that it's error, but you focus on the prejudice portion of the analysis?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's what I was trying to get across in my brief.
And that's what you meant by to the extent counsel saw it?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're hedging.
You say at any point that the decision of the Court of Criminal Appeals was incorrect?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where?
Well, I didn't say it in my brief.
Oh, okay. You're going to argue it now. You're going to argue it now.
No, no, not at all. Not at all. In United States versus Fletcher, this honorable court lists several factors used to assess the cumulative impact of any prosecutorial misconduct on the appellant's substantial rights and the fairness and integrity of the trial, to include the severity of the misconduct, the measures adopted to cure the misconduct, and the weight of evidence, in this case, supporting the sentence that was received. The severity of the misconduct. Again, assuming arguendo that this was error, the embodiments of evil comment took place in the first paragraph of an approximately 20-page argument. The comment about appellant being evil and that the place for evil is hell took place in the last few sentences. In the body of appellant's argument, or trial counsel's argument, excuse me, he gave three reasons why the appellant deserved life without the possibility of parole. The first reason being the horror of the crimes coupled with the volume of offenses. Bottom line, this was the ultimate betrayal of trust by a parent towards a child. And the trial counsel calculated based on appellant's youngest daughter's stipulation.
Can you hold your place for a second for a question? Presumption that the judge knows the law.
Yes, sir.
If a judge is presumed to know the law, what should we assume or conclude, if anything, from the judge's silence when counsel opens his statement with a reference to Hitler? Presumably the judge knows that this is not a trial about Hitler. So is the judge, should the judge have said, counsel, what's that have to do with anything, or not, if he's presumed to know the law? Is you can argue it either way, so I'm looking for which way you argue it.
The judge did not, he was not required to have to say, you know, to stop trial counsel and say, you know, hey, don't argue this or anything like that. By him being presumed to know the law, he takes the argument for what it's worth. So to the extent that the argument was inappropriate or improper, he would not have considered it in sentencing.
So if the counsel got up and said, this guy's really guilty, he consulted a lawyer, he wouldn't testify, he's asserted his Fifth Amendment right, and we all know he's guilty, it's fine to presume the judge knows the law and he should just sit there silently through the statement, so long as it's judge alone?
I think with that hypothetical, no, the judge...
Then what's the difference? Hitler's a pretty extreme example of a person. There's no more heinous example of a criminal.
I guess the difference between the hypothetical and trial counsel's argument would be that in the hypothetical, the appellant would have a constitutional right, you know, to have counsel, what have you, and it's inappropriate to comment on that. However, with a passing reference to Hitler or Hussein,
remember, I'm focusing on the judge's role here. If he's presumed to know the law, if he's presumed to know the law, then he's presumed that he's not going to apply the right to remain silent and all that. And why should he speak up then if he doesn't speak up now, or vice versa?
I mean, because it's a presumption that he knows the law. I mean, because he is presumed to know the law, he's not required to speak up. The second part of that being that he's going to follow the law. And there's no clear evidence to the contrary that he didn't follow the law. So it's the United States' contention that he was not required to stop trial counsel's argument. And even it's quite possible that in the context that the trial counsel argued Hussein and bin Laden, I'll retract that.
My question was predicated on assuming it was error.
Right, right.
And so, yeah.
Is the concept of error different in a members' trial from a judge-alone trial? Is there a uniform standard, or is it a different thing?
For members' trial, the military judge would give the members instructions, and in that respect, the members are presumed to follow the military judge's instructions, absent clear evidence to the contrary.
But there's no requirement the judge instruct himself
exactly.
In a judge alone trial.
Exactly.
Counsel, are you aware of any case in which this court has found plain error in a sentencing argument in a judge alone trial? I'm sorry, can you answer audibly?
I'm actually thinking, Your Honor, I apologize. No, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case.
But it's a tricky one, isn't it? If a judge is presumed to know the law and there's no objection, there's a little bit of a circularity there, isn't there?
Right, because the defense counsel, you know, presumably would...
Hopefully, well, we can ask that question of other counsel as well.
With the three reasons, going back to that, the horror of the crimes, the impact on the victims, danger to society that the appellant represents, the sentence that the appellant received was the one that he deserved. As far as the second prong under Fletcher, the curative measures, as Your Honor pointed out, there was no objection by defense counsel, and judges are presumed to know the law and to follow it absent clear evidence to the contrary, and there's no clear evidence that the military judge did not follow the law. And finally, the weight of the evidence supporting the sentence, in researching the case, researching case law, this is probably one of the most damaging, if you will, sex offenses that's come before a military tribunal. And bottom line, the appellant did receive the sentence that he deserved. So in conclusion, it was not trial counsel making.
Is that the issue in the case? Whether he received the issue, whether he received the sentence he deserved, aren't we proceeding on the assumption that the sentence, had there been proper argument, was appropriate? And then the question is whether the comments in the argument affected the sentence?
That is correct, Your Honor. And the comments in the argument did not affect the sentence. Trial counsel asked for a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. The military judge gave appellant life. So appellant, there is a possibility for parole for appellant. It does give him hope. Therefore, there was no material prejudice in trial counsel's argument.
Now, in the government's brief, you argue that the sentence comparisons are irrelevant. You alluded to some sentence comparisons, however, in your argument. What would be the basis for the analysis that you've given that this is one of the most severe cases of sexual abuse to ever come before a military court? We've seen quite a few.
I understand.
We've seen quite a few with some pretty significant factual circumstances that
understand
that we look at. And that
my response was in response to defense counsel's brief and the cases that he had cited. Those cases that were cited in the appellant's brief did not come close to what the appellant in this case did.
I see. So you're distinguishing his citations rather than making an independent argument comparing to all cases that have come before this court.
And that, yes.
That's thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank the government for the argument. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
How do you break into the plain error judges presumed to know the law circle?
Counsel are presumed to be competent as well, but everyone does make mistakes, and that's just the nature of the business, is that there's no perfect trial.
How would we know the judge is made a mistake and isn't presumed to have discounted improper argument, if he's not required to instruct himself?
Yes, Your Honor, in this case, we look to the prongs, the first and third prong of Fletcher, and that's the severity of the misconduct and then also the weight of the misconduct. Considering the seriousness of the misconduct that was committed by the trial counsel, on the continuum of seriousness, making the references to appellant going to hell and the three public figures, that does grade high on that scale. And then when the weight of the misconduct, there were some redeeming factors that could help counsel make the argument that life confinement is not appropriate. There were some mitigators, so based on those two things, it's tough to say that the judge was not influenced by trial counsel's argument in this case. The 22 pages of trial counsel argument, they have the themes.
Is the injection of religion?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is the injection of religion into sentencing argument per se inflammatory and prejudicial?
No, Your Honor.
It is not.
No, well, it is inflammatory, Your Honor. There can be some latitude given to counsel depending upon the way that it's addressed. If it's if the door has been opened for some reason, I know there's a recent case, Armstrong.
Go ahead. Okay, to follow up on something Judge Ryan said earlier, what does the reference in your brief on page 10 to the closely held spiritual views of the military judge mean? I believe you said earlier that there was nothing in the record to indicate that the judge held any particular religious views or any at all.
Correct, Your Honor, and I tried to clear that up on a footnote by saying that although there's no reference to the judge's particular religion or spirituality, there is sort of an internal moral compass that we all have, and by trying to inflame that, that can result in prejudice, and that's what it did in this case.
I mean, for all we know, this military judge is entirely agnostic in the reference to the devil, which you seem to be saying is your best argument, and if that's not what you're saying, please correct me. Would have no impact whatsoever. And I think you said before that you don't disagree that it would be a fair argument to say that this person was evil.
Your Honor, evil, would be fair depending upon the context. In this context, it was prejudicial. Even if the military judge is agnostic, this can still play a particular role in his deliberative process because no matter what someone's faith is, they still have this internal guiding compass, if you will, where they have to distinguish between right and wrong. And there's this objective acceptance of the devil as being on one end of being wrong, and that's what the trial counsel tried to work into his argument improperly, and therefore the judge could rely upon that then to fashion a sentence in this case that was inappropriate.
The question isn't whether the sentence was inappropriate. The question is whether trial counsel's argument here is what caused the sentence to be what it was. Now, government counsel is pointing out that what appellant asked for in this case, I'm sorry, what the trial counsel asked for in this case was life without parole. What he got was life. The offenses were serious. Point specifically as to what it is we look to say that passing references in the beginning of an argument in the context of the offenses of this case and all the evidence that was before the military judge, that there was prejudice.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I?
We'll have to ask the chief judge, but I suspect he'll let you answer my question.
Why don't you take what time you need to answer the question, and then if there are no further questions, you may briefly conclude.
Yes, Your Honor. On the prejudice prong, that's where we consider the quote at the end saying that, and if I may turn to it. Basically saying that the appellant is going to hell. The victims in this case, the children, should not have to suffer one day before he goes there. And indeed does reference that it's only a matter of time until indeed the appellant is going to go to hell. Considering that reference, the underlying themes of betrayal and manipulation, which go back to Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, and Adolf Hitler as being the master manipulators and betrayers of trust, taken together, the references to those three, as well as a demon, the devil, and going to hell, Although plain error analysis does presume that the law does presume that a military judge knows the law and applies it, there are times where that presumption has to be overcome by the facts and circumstances of the case. And that's what we have in the United States versus Erickson. We request that this honorable court set aside the sentence.
You're not asserting that defense counsel is ineffective for not objecting, are you?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will stand in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.
The court stands in recess until